A number of years ago, I had the opportunity to talk to a lady in the faith and asked her if there were some special prayer or service or sermon that she remembered. She said, "I'll tell you one I'll never forget. I've never met Angelo B. Trena, but Elder Trena was a man that actually was instrumental in getting the first Sacred Name Bible prepared. Anyway, he got up in front of the group and he said, 'I am Antichrist.' He said it again, 'I am Antichrist.' And the people's mouth dropped open and didn't know what he was getting into. Well, he said, you find if you look it up, the word anti means either against or for. And I want you to know that I'm against Christ. It's a Greek word. We're trying to make Yahshua a Greek out of being a Jew. And it doesn't work. Well, I'm going to talk about the Antichrist that the Bible talks about. But Elder Trena spent all his time talking about the twisting of words and so on, that we have a Greek savior. His name ends in S-U-S, which is a nominative masculine singular for the nominative case in the first declension. But it actually means nothing because that was never his name. Anyway, I want you to turn with me to something else. I want to talk about the Antichrist. The Anti-Messiah is really what we should call him. And we're told that he will be here one of these days. Let's turn to Matthew 24. In Matthew 24, we have what is known as the Olivet Prophecy. And it is here that Yahshua himself spoke about this selfsame affair. He talked about the Anti-Messiah. Chapter 24. And move on down there to verse 14. And basically this verse 14 says that this message is going to be preached not to convert the world, not to change the world over into following Yahshua, but it's a warning, a witness, something that's going to be taking place. And verse 14 says, "This evangel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations." So the evangel is for a warning to those who are not aware of what is going to take place in the future. And it says it will take place. And we are given some insight into what will happen in the books of Daniel and some of the others, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and the Old Testament, as well as Revelation and what we have here in the Olivet Prophecy. But notice verse 15. It says, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in that holy place. Whosoever reads, let him understand." So he says that there is going to be an abomination of desolation in the holy place. What does that really mean? Let's go over to the book of 2 Thessalonians. In 2 Thessalonians, we actually get an insight into the things that are taking place and preparatory to Yahshua's return. Excuse me. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, notice it reads, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Savior and by our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind or troubled, neither in spirit, nor by word, nor by letter, as from us, that the time of Yahweh is at hand. Let no man deceive you by any means." If you've ever read the book of Matthew and 24, and you notice Yahshua says, "Don't be deceived, don't be deceived," that is the one big thing that the Anti-Messiah is going to try to do, is deceive the people. Notice he says, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except the come of falling away first." There's going to be a great falling away. And I think a lot of us believe it's already taken place. Half the world and half of our nation even doesn't really believe in the Bible anymore. They've gone their own way. But he says that man of sin will be revealed, the son of perdition. Verse 4, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called Elohim or that is worshipped, so that he as Elohim sits in the temple of Elohim, showing himself to be Elohim. What is interesting here, it tells us two things. Number one, there's going to be a temple before Messiah returns. And we find that this individual is going to oppose and exalt himself above whatever is called Elohim. And that word temple is interesting. It's a Greek word. It's naos. Naos means an inner sanctum, that within. The Holy of Holies is really what we believe it's talking about. Had it been the Greek word hieron, that simply means the temple in itself, the hallways and the rooms and whatever was there. But this says in the sacred place, in the holy place, this man is going to be. And he will show or prove by that he is indeed the returned Elohim, the returned Yahshua. But he goes on to talk about this. But this abomination is going to be in the holy place. And I believe that's going to happen after he's challenged. And you find that back in the book of Daniel. Maybe we ought to turn back there. Because in the book of Daniel, there's a couple things we want to get a look at. And I do believe that if we understand some of these things a little better, why we won't be deceived as quickly as we might be. But in the book of Daniel, let's go to chapter 8. And in chapter 8 is really a vision that Daniel gets, as you find out, in his dream. And we find here in chapter 8, move on down to verse 11. And there it says, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. Now it's talking about the man of sin, the anti-Messiah. And it says, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. So here we find his sanctuary was cast down. Some of these things we have a difficult time trying to comprehend what will happen. But we find here there's going to be this man of sin that is going to be on the earth. And if you want to go over to the 11th chapter and notice verse 21. Most of the scholars feel that in the 11th chapter, from verse 1 down through verse 20, that these things have all taken place. I'm not saying they have. They could be just a forerunner of what's going to happen. But from verse 21 onward, most scholars agree this never has taken place. So here we find that in his place shall stand up a vile person. And again, this is talking about the man of sin, the anti-Messiah. And to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Rather interesting that there is a forerunner that we should take a look at, because generally when the first time you see something in the scripture, take a good look at it. If you want to read about Passover, go back to the 12th chapter of Exodus and read it, because that's where it first appears. And after that, all the rest of it has to tie with it. Don't go jumping off into some place in the New Testament and then try to work backwards. It doesn't work that way. When you get something brand new the first time, take a good look at it. And you'll find that in the book of Daniel, what we just read here, pretty well covers it in verse 21. He's a vile person. But the people don't know that. They're being deceived. And that's why the word deception is always there. But I want to take you over here to what happened with the early assembly. And what, some of the questions that have come along with it. Over in the, let's see, I want to go back here to the book of Daniel, back to, let's see, chapter 8 again. In chapter 8, I want you to notice here in verse 8, it's giving us the history of Alexander the Great, is really what this is. Verse 8 talks about the goat that is mentioned over here in the beginning of the chapter. Verse 5 is the goat. But he talks about this goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken off. This goat, to save you a lot of time, the goat represents the Grecian Empire. And in this Grecian Empire was a man by the name of Alexander. A young man, 25 years old, he conquered all the known world in his day. And he died at a young age of in his early 30s. Now it says here that when he was strong, the great horn was broken. For it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now, these four, what this is talking about? Alexander died in Babylon. He died there as a young man, and his four generals took his place. There were actually five, but one of them didn't qualify. But these four generals each took a part of his territory. Ptolemy had Egypt, and you find that Greece was under Cassander, and also the other one was Nicator. He had Asia Minor. But the other one you want to look at is one that took over Syria. His name was Seleucus. And he took this over as part of the heritage that he got by being a general for Alexander. So we have now Seleucus, the Syrian, who is at war, is always at war, it seems like, with Egypt. And that's the other general, the name was Ptolemy. And they were always warring back and forth. Finally, Seleucus, or the one that was leading the Grecian Empire in Syria, was actually the one that was victorious over the Egyptian army. And you find there that Israel was in the middle, and they would war back and forth. And Israel was not a warfaring nation. Very seldom did they do anything that was wrong, but they always had to pay taxes either to Egypt or to Syria, Egypt or Syria, back and forth all the time. Well, we find here that there was a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. And he was the one that was the one from Syria. And he was making war against Egypt, and he already won one battle. So he was going back the second time. And he's going back there to kind of clean everything up, make sure everything is the way it should be. And on the way back, he was met by a courier. And this courier was from Rome. And he was sent there by the Roman Senate. And the Roman Senate had told this courier that you tell this Antiochus Epiphanes to go on back home again. Don't make war against Egypt. The reason being, Rome was fearful that Syria would become the nation that would compete with them. Because they were Rome was on the northern part of the Red Sea. And you have these other two nations, Egypt and Syria on the south. And if they united, they would be bigger than Rome could handle. And so Antiochus Epiphanes didn't know what he ought to do. He thought, well, here I have victory in the palm of my hand. I'm able to overcome Egypt. And yet I get a warning message here from Rome. I better not attack or they're going to come down after me. So what does he do? Well, he decides what he's going to do. He's going back to Syria, save his army. But as he's doing that, he goes back to Jerusalem. Now, it's rather interesting, unless you understand the ways of the people in those days, what they did. They would actually make war and try to demolish their enemy's army. Once that was demolished, the next thing they would do, they would go in and make them follow whatever deities they were worshiping. And Egypt had their own. Well, you know that the plagues were all against Egypt and all their many idolatrous things they worshipped. And Egypt had their own, and so each one had their own. But Antiochus Epiphanes went into Jerusalem, went into the Holy of Holies, and actually demanded that they worship what he was going to set up in there. He had his men bring a pig. They slaughtered a pig on the altar. And the reason they did that, he was trying to get the Jews to be his subjects. Because he thought, if I can't have Egypt, I'll take over Jerusalem. I'll take over the Jews. I'll take over the land of Israel. And that's what he did. The whole concept there was, you see, they wanted to get the people humiliated. And the way they did it was to bring in their own deities that they worshipped and told the people to worship these new deities, because, after all, they lost the war, didn't they? Their army was demolished. And the ones that were the victors were the ones that demanded worship of their deities. In fact, if you read back in about, after this, you'll find that Constantine had his men put an X on their shields, because that's the deity they were going to worship. And so we always have the cross, you know, and that's supposed to be Christian. Well, if you know any history, that's kind of a ragtag idea. But I don't want to get into that. But here we have Antiochus Epiphanes slaughtering, having a pig slaughtered on the altar, and trying to get the Jews to accept him as the king, as their new ruler. Well, actually, it didn't really work out that way. See, there were actually two groups of people, two groups of Jews, you might say. One of them was the ones that were being influenced by the Egyptians, and they were rather benign. You also had another group that we know today as the Pharisees. They were the ones that were being subdued by the Greek intellectual ways of life. And they were the ones that were trying to introduce Greek ideas into the Jewish way of living and worship and so on. So the next thing that Antiochus Epiphanes was going to do, you see, was not only to get the people to worship his deities, and he put this pig on the altar, and he told them that they were to worship their deities. In fact, he went into the Holy of Holies. He looked all around for little deities and icons and so on like that that he could take out of there and take them and set up his own in the temple. And then at the foot of these deities of his, they would put the other little deities of the conquered land. And they would say, look, our deities are stronger. Yours are down there worshiping on the foot of our deities. And that was one way how they humiliated the worship. However, that didn't really always work out that way, because in this instance, there were some Jews that actually were a little bit different than that. We find that the Maccabees are the ones that we're going to take a look at, because there was Matthias and his five sons. And the third son was Judas Maccabees. And instead of bowing down to worship, the Jews rebelled against it. And there were 80,000 of them killed within just a short time. A lot of them fled and just left. But Judas Maccabees and his men actually had kind of a guerrilla warfare on the Syrians. And within 3 years, they were driven out. The Syrians left Egypt or left Israel. But we find here that this third step was to assimilate the defeated foe and get them to be a part of their culture. And that's what they were trying to do. And you see, when you find out these steps, then you understand that maybe this is what the anti-Messiah is going to try to do. Because Antiochus Epiphanes is pretty well known as the first man of sin, or the one that is a prototype of the one that's coming at the tail end of the time we're in right now. And it's a third step, of course, was to assimilate the defeated foe, have him take over their way of thinking and so on. See, actually, the Greek, you might say the Hellenistic, really, way of life in their culture was far above what the Jews were doing. The Jews didn't have many of these things like their plays and their Olympics, athletics, things like that. That was something that they started doing after the Syrians had been there, and with this Greek philosophy and the Greek way of doing things. But what is interesting, see, we're getting a little short of time here. I wanted to mention here that the I wonder if I can find where I was going to read it. That it was actually the great thing that the man of sin was going to be one of the great leaders of his time. In fact, here it is. This was Clarence Larkin. He wrote a book on Revelation, his commentary. He said, "The man of sin will be a composite man, one who embraces in his character the abilities and powers of Nebuchadnezzar and Xerxes of Persia, Alexander the Great of Greece, Caesar Augustus of Rome. He will have the marvelous gift of attracting unregenerate men, irresistible fascination of his personality, his versatile attainments, his superhuman wisdom, great administrative and executive ability, along with his powers as a consummate flatterer, a brilliant diplomat, that he is a superb strategist. He will, this will all make him the most conspicuous and prominent of all men. And all these gifts will be conferred on him by Satan." So we have here just the beginning of how this all is probably going to come about. Some man will come on the scene and very subtly will rise to power. In fact, when you go back and read the 11th chapter of Daniel, if you want to go back there with me, when you go back, you'll notice that he does all sorts of things that a diplomat would do at the cost of other people. For example, in the 11th chapter of Daniel, as you move back there, it does give us a warning in verse 35 that there's going to be rebellion against him, because there's going to be some of those of understanding that will try, that will be tried and purged and be made white at the time of the end. And this is all appointed. Yahweh knows it's going to happen. But notice in verse 36, it says, "The king shall do according to his will." This is talking about the man of sin, about the anti-Messiah. "He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every deity. He shall speak marvelous things against the mighty one of all deities and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the mighty one of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any mighty one, any Eloah, for he shall magnify himself above all." Verse 38, I've always thought that was interesting. It's almost as if he worships technology, modern things of warfare. "In his estate shall he honor the mighty one of forces, a deity whom his fathers knew not, shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange mighty one, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. He shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. What he's probably going to do is break up the land and give it to certain people if they're faithful to him and do what he wants them to do. And then we find at that time shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, and the chariots and horsemen and many ships. Of course, the writer, Daniel here, chariots and horsemen could well be some sort of mechanized tanks and armored vehicles and so on. But it says, he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter into the glorious land. That's talking about the land of Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab. Edom and Moab, you know, are the children of Lot and his daughters. And the chief of the Jordan of Ammon, which is Jordan. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold, treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. That is, they'll be subservient to him, doing whatever he wants them to do. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth and with great fury to destroy, utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. And he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. What that really says in verse 45, he's going to eventually end up in the Holy Land, in Israel, set up his palace there. And it is there that probably, see in Daniel 9:27, he talks about the 7 years that he makes with the people, 70 weeks. Chances are that in the middle of the week, that is, after 3.5 years, he will actually change and no longer be the beneficent, nice guy. He'll actually be turning on the people. And this is where the 3.5 years and so on all comes forth. It comes forth after he's in Daniel 11:45. That is when he comes to his end, and then it goes on to talk more about it here in chapter 12. But the interesting point is that Antiochus Epiphanes is apparently the first one, and he is the one that wanted to change, first of all, worship. And there are really 4 steps that Yahweh has noted to some of his people that the world is taking. First of all, they teach that there is no mighty one. They say God is dead. The other one is that he did not create everything. It all just evolved. And he tries to do away with all these things. And as we look around our world, we can see that there are no actual rules of governing. So people will say there's no way you can tell which is truth. Truth has come to an end. So it's an attack really upon the things that we hold dear, the things the Bible talks about, and yet we find that so many of these things are just coming to the fore now, and we have to back off and look at what is really going on in this world. And the various steps that have been taken with Antiochus Epiphanes to change the Jews that were left there in the land didn't work. He couldn't change them. Finally, they were thrown out. But the point is that many of the people are going to face martyrdom. We're going to have that in spite of what the churches teach about a rapture and you go off to heaven and roll around heaven all day. But actually, the anti-Messiah, we don't really know who it is yet. But I do believe that when we see it, we have to be very careful. he's going to be someone that the world will all turn to. They'll think he's a wonderful guy. He does all these things right. He makes no mistakes. And he's probably going to come along, and instead of trying to teach Sunday worship like the Adventist Church teaches, he's probably going to sit in the temple and pretend to be Messiah returned. Because in the 24th chapter of Matthew, Yahshua said, "Pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath." Why would he say that if we're not going to be keeping the Sabbath under the anti-Messiah? He'll deceive the world that he's keeping the days that Yahweh has set apart. And at the end of the 3.5 years, he'll turn on the people and we'll find out his true colors. And I believe that that's another talk, but it's an interesting concept, not to get the idea that all these things are going to happen and that we have no way of knowing what's going to be next. Generally, I think we can look at what's happened so far and know that Yahweh's in charge. Everything's going to turn out all right. It's just a matter of time and being faithful until Yahshua returns. May Yahweh bless you.